This is episode number 782 of the Secret Identity Podcast, and today on What's New, we're going to talk about Justice League, Spider-Man, and Black Panther. Our comics this week will be Darth Vader number 1, The Last number 1, and The Flintstones number 12. Our summer reading project continues this week with some more case files from Judge Dredd. We're going to be talking about You Bet Your Life through the CompuTel story. And our creator spotlight this week is Chris Fizikas, the creator and writer of The Last, who I spoke to at Connecticut GamerCon 2017.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you.
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
You have 20 seconds to comply.
Good, clean, wholesome fun.
And welcome, everybody, to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letendry here, as always, with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
Doing well and ready to go. It's been busy. You've been busy coming into this. I was busy a little earlier today. We are ready to go.
As we record this today, my daughter has graduated eighth grade.
Yep.
She was 3 years old when we started the show.
Yep.
Now she is 13, and she is going to her first semi-formal tonight.
Very nice.
So, yes, that's a lot of dad stuff I had to deal with today. Lots of emotions.
Yep.
Was in a glass case of emotion for a little while today.
That happens.
But let's jump right into our news, Matthew. We have a lots of stuff to talk about today. We're going to start with a story out of The Hollywood Reporter. Superman, Batman, and now Elfman. Danny Elfman is set to dole out the sweet sound of justice, coming on board to compose the score for Justice League, Warner Brothers all-star superhero extravaganza, The Hollywood Reporter has learned. The hiring comes just as additional photography with director Joss Whedon standing in for Zack Snyder for the movie gets underway in London. Whedon is overseeing the new shoot and post-production work on Justice League after Snyder stepped aside to deal with a family tragedy. Snyder had been working with Antonius Tom Holkenborg, a.k.a. Junkie XL, on the movie. Holkenborg, who scored Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice and has other movies like Mad Max Fury Road and Deadpool among his credits, is now moving on to Tomb Raider, according to sources. Elfman has some familiarity with coming in late on projects and with working with Whedon. He was brought on board in the later stages of the making of Whedon's 2015 superhero movie, Avengers: Age of Ultron, adding to the music already written by Brian Tyler. Elfman is one of the big names in the movie music field, known for his longtime work on with director Tim Burton, early comic book movies Batman and Batman Returns, among them. He also worked with Sam Raimi on Spider-Man and Spider-Man 2, among the filmmaker's other titles. So, Matthew, excited?
I'm very excited. Now, I was wondering how far the credits for Danny Elfman were going to go back.
Uh-huh.
Because The Simpsons.
Darkman.
He has done a ton of TV stuff.
I believe he did the Army of Darkness score, I'm not mistaken.
So here's the thing that a lot of people sometimes seem to forget. He was the former lead singer of Oingo Boingo.
Right.
And if you remember the movie Back to School,
uh-huh,
when Oingo Boingo was playing and when they had the party at the dorm that—
Yes.
That is— – oh, no. I'm sorry. It wasn't Oingo Boingo. It wasn't that movie. It was Weird Science.
It was Weird Science when they had the motorcycle gang that crashed into the party,
right? I think Oingo Boingo was in both, but Weird Science was— –
where the motorcycle gang shows up.
Flaming red hair.
Yeah.
Really kind of very animated with his face. This is a guy that started out as a new wave musician and has now turned into one of the most sought-after movie scorers and TV score guys ever.
Yep.
Which is great. I'm really excited.
Yes. I have very fond memories of the credits of the original Spider-Man movie and just hearing the Elfman score.
Yep.
And also as it sort of wove through the web.
Yes.
And you saw all the lettering and stuff like that. Yeah. I mean, that is certainly nothing but a positive. Mm-hmm. When you see Danny Elfman associated with the score of a superhero movie.
Yeah. I mean, it's you look at the fact like Devo, the guys in Devo now score half the TV shows on Nickelodeon.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Mark Mothersbaugh and then a couple other guys. But this is what our new wave musicians of the late 80s or early 80s, late 70s, early 80s are doing now, and they're doing good work.
They're doing all right for themselves.
Yes, they are.
Yes. Well, I just mentioned Spider-Man, and I want to continue mentioning Spider-Man, Matthew, because at the PlayStation event that happened at E3 the other day, which for those that are not gamers is the Electronic Entertainment Expo. This is the big show that happens every spring where you have Microsoft and Sony and Nintendo and a lot of the bigger publishers like Bethesda and Ubisoft and EA. They show up and they talk about what is coming for them for the rest of the year and what people can expect next year, early next year from them as well. And it's like the New York Comic Con event for the games industry. And there's lots of big reveals. They just revealed the new Xbox One X, which is the sort of half step between a new console for Xbox, and all of the publishers, you know, talk about their big games that are coming. Well, there is a Spider-Man game coming from Insomniac. At today's event, it said the other day, Insomniac Games unveiled a deeper look at the developer's first licensed game featuring the friendly neighborhood wall crawler himself. The game now has an official title. No shocker to anyone, Spider-Man. The footage featured Spider-Man in his unique in-game costume, which is different than all of the ones you've seen in the comics and everything else, featuring a white spider emblem. Spidey leapt, ran straight up walls, webbed bad guys, took advantage of his environment in a way reminiscent of the Arkham franchise, though with considerably more direct sunlight and witty repartee to take out a gang encroaching on the territory of Wilson Fisk, a.k.a. the Kingpin. It even looked like his characteristic spider sense was employed to allow him to dodge blows. And a stinger at the very end of the press conference confirmed the appearance of another Spider-Man entirely, Miles Morales.
Oh.
So there's this scene at the end of the footage that they showed where you see someone kind of filming on their iPhone and the person turns around, it's Miles Morales.
Wow.
So my kind of question for the game, which as I understand it, is neither tied to the new movie or any particular comic book storyline. I believe that they're able to do whatever they want with this. Is that maybe, my hope is that maybe we'll see Miles either as a playable character as well or as someone who's going to play a major role in that game. So that's exciting stuff. That game looks amazing. That was probably the thing that I was most excited about that Sony talked about the entire week at E3. So I'm pretty stoked about that. And sticking in the Marvel Universe, Matthew, judging by the numbers, viewers are ready to take a trip to the African nation of Wakanda. The teaser trailer for Black Panther, Marvel Studios' upcoming movie based on the character created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, generated 89 million views in the first 24 hours of its debut. The spot debuted Friday during the first quarter of Game 4 of the NBA Finals on ABC. It was then released on various social media platforms. The numbers are welcome news for Marvel as it shows strong interest in the upcoming standalone film, which is a gutsier venture for the studio that has in many cases relied on the familiarity of its main cast of Avengers to float its standalone picks. Black Panther features an unprecedented, predominantly black cast and no box office titans, and his appearance in Captain America Civil War notwithstanding, stars a character that is not largely known on the level of other superheroes. Chadwick Boseman is playing T'Challa, the king of the fictional African nation of Wakanda, who must defend the people from threats internal and external. Ryan Coogler directed the movie, which is now set to bow February 16, 2018. The 89 million view figure includes 19 million views from those watching the NBA Finals. While the trailer for Thor Ragnarok is Marvel and parent company Disney's most watched ever, that has 136 million views, Black Panther lands in the top three of most watched Marvel trailer content. Now, what's interesting about that is that was literally in the first 24 hours.
Yeah.
So a lot of people are interested in that movie.
And the interesting thing is they count trailers. I mean, you obviously now are looking at...
I know, right?
All right, dude, we got the number one trailer in the world.
I mean, it makes perfect sense in this age of Google and of search engine optimization and everything else and in download numbers and subscriber numbers and all that kind of stuff that they would absolutely keep track of that because it helps them sort of chart projections for what they think this movie might do at the box office, right? But certainly, very strong response to that. The trailer looks freaking...
It does.
Fantastic, right? It's exactly what you want. It seems to be spending a ton of time in Wakanda. It seems to be certainly connected to the rest of the Marvel Universe, but not reliant on it. And so I am super excited for that. And Andy Serkis, who obviously most of us fell in love with during Lord of the Rings because he played Gollum.
Mm-hmm.
But he also did the motion capture for King Kong.
Yep.
And he's also been in a billion other things. And he was in King Kong as the cook, right? I think he was.
I have not seen King Kong.
You what?
I did not see King Kong. Came at a tough time. Yeah, we've realized that there was a block when we were dealing with a lot of the stuff with my father-in-law.
Sure.
There was a block of we didn't see that one. I still haven't seen Doctor Strange.
I would like, because I think you in particular would appreciate that movie, I would like for us to do a Saturday matinee of Peter Jackson's King Kong.
Oh, Peter Jackson's King Kong.
Yeah, yeah.
The new one. I did. Oh, the new one. Yeah, I'm thinking who did the last one? When you said Peter Jackson, I went
You're talking about Kong of Skull Island.
Yeah, you're talking the new one, right?
No.
Oh, you're talking
I'm talking about the Peter Jackson one that starred Jack Black.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, I didn't see
Skull. And Andy Serkis plays the cook from the boat.
Yes.
And so he plays a major part in it, but he also did the motion capture for King Kong himself.
Did not hate that movie. I thought that was a very good movie that
I did too.
Really got destroyed by people.
Well, the problem was it was a little self-indulgent because it was over 3 hours long.
Yes.
But as a standalone film, I really liked it.
Very enjoyable.
We should talk more about that film. You did not see the new one?
No, I didn't see the new one.
Oh, dude. The new one. Trust me. If you had any problems with that one being too slow or anything, you will not have that problem with this King Kong. This King Kong punches you right in the face from the second it starts.
Nice.
And then it does not let go the whole rest of the ride. The new King Kong is amazing. I'm super excited about the monster universe moving forward. But man, Black Panther.
Freaking
awesome. I mean, when you thought about what Marvel has to go up against with DC and Wonder Woman and then Justice League, and you were looking at the slate and you were thinking, well, you know, they have Guardians, but then it's Thor and then it's Black Panther. Are those movies going to be able to stand up to what DC is going to be doing? Because we knew Wonder Woman was going to be big. Maybe the predictions were not as big as it has become. And Justice League could be the worst movie in the world. It's going to do gangbusters.
Yes.
Everybody's going to go see Justice League no matter what the critics think of it or anything like that. So to have your lesser known characters in Thor, even though this is his third movie, and in Black Panther coming up, that almost seemed like a disadvantage for Marvel. But the Thor Ragnarok trailer was freaking unbelievable.
Yes.
It reminds me of Flash Gordon.
Yeah.
And then the Black Panther trailer is unbelievable. So they're looking okay right now.
I think they are. It's not it's really interesting when you think of we think of Black Panther. We certainly don't think of him as the lesser of the known characters because we love Black Panther. However, in the world of people that don't know the characters other than the movies and what they've seen, Black Panther is not that huge known commodity. He's going in more of a unknown than Ant-Man did, I think. And this one, what I loved about this trailer is you saw exactly what I want from this. I want Wakanda. I want the world to not even know it's there, or if they do see it, they see it as this very basic country, you know, the huts and the dirt roads and stuff like that. But on the inside, it is like this. It's what it is. And I wanted to see some political wrangling, and it looks like we're going to get a lot of that in this.
Well, I thought they did a good job in the trailer of when you get introduced to Andy Serkis, you don't know he's the bad guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's being interrogated, right?
Yes.
And you're wondering, and then you see the Hobbit, Watson.
Yep.
I can't remember his name. The actor that plays Watson in Sherlock and the actor
And
he also was the Hobbit in Peter Jackson's The Hobbit. He is now, it's Marty Freeman is the Megadeth guitar player.
Marty Freeman, I believe, because he was
I think it's Martin Freeman.
He was the Jim character in the UK Office.
Correct.
So Jim Krasinski has created an entire career basing himself on him.
Well, and he's a SHIELD agent, right? In the Marvel Universe now? Because I know he was in Captain America's Civil War.
Yes, he was. Yep.
So I think he was in that before. So I know he's part of the Marvel Universe, but I didn't immediately realize that Andy Serkis was the bad guy.
Yeah.
And then he's talking about, what do you know about Wakanda? You know, and it's this secret place and I've seen it and I've laid eyes on it and stuff like that. And it gave it this sort of mysterious sort of vibe, which I thought was really cool. And so anyways, that movie's going to be awesome. Man, embarrassment of riches in terms of movies right now. We had Guardians, we had Wonder Woman.
Yep.
Then I think Thor's up next.
I thought we had Spider-Man next? We have Spider-Man next month.
On my birthday.
On your birthday,
yes. On my birthday is – and when is Thor? August?
August or September? I'm not sure exactly when, but I know –
Oh, you know what? No, Thor must be November because February of 2018 is Black Panther. Okay, so Spider-Man, Thor, Black Panther.
Star Wars.
But then this fall, we're getting Justice League and we're getting Star Wars.
Yes.
I mean,
Yep. It's a nice time.
What more can you ask for?
It's a nice time.
It's unbelievable. Okay. So, yeah, excited for that stuff. We do have a somber note to mention here today because on Facebook, if you follow Tommy Castillo, who is an amazing artist,
yep,
who we have known forever.
Yes.
The early days of Secret, and anyone who is part of the New York comic book scene or a comic book podcast scene knows who Tommy Castillo is. And he has had a lot of health problems over the years. He has diabetes. He's gone through some really rough surgeries. We heard this week from his wife, Samantha, who is one of the most amazing people I've ever seen in my entire life, that he is in really bad shape.
Yep.
He is basically at home now, and according to her, he's receiving hospice care, and they're not sure how much longer he has left. It sounds like his liver is failing, and it's just a really tough situation. And for anybody who's been following that situation over the past few years, it's been a really tough situation. Yep. There's been some great crowdfunding efforts to help pay for his medical expenses because obviously, as we know, the comic book industry doesn't have an insurance plan. And the comic book industry often has creators who have medical expenses that they can't pay for and stuff like that. So the community has been amazing and very supportive, but that was super sad news. So, you know, our hearts go out to Tommy, to Samantha, to all of their friends and family. This has been a super difficult time. And if you go to the Facebook page for Tommy Castillo, you can find links to different fundraising organizations, different charities that you can donate to, and also just post your words of support.
Yeah.
Because the family is with him now, and it is it's a really rough situation. And so it's just super sad. I mean, especially when you know somebody and to see them kind of going through that. And he's like our age.
Yeah.
So it's not something that you expect to happen. But if you, again, have been around the New York scene at all, then chances are you have seen Tommy at a show. If you've ever had a chance to talk to Tommy, you know that he was a super nice guy. And we had great conversations with him, especially at the old Big Apple shows,
yeah,
which I was thinking a lot about as I was kind of watching the latest update from his wife today. And man, she is just a stronger person than I could ever possibly be in my entire life,
yep,
and just amazing. So yeah, really, really sad stuff.
Yeah, and we were watching it upstairs a little before you came in, and it just to show you kind of the impact that Tommy has had on my life. My wife, the first thing she said was, "Don't tell Rebecca. We got to figure this one out," because Becky met Tommy. We met Tommy probably 5 years before Secret Identity,
right?
When he was the brand new artist on Detective Comics, and we went to a national show, which was the big November show that the Big Apple shows, the Big Apple Con would do,
yep,
in November. And I remember bringing the first couple issues to get him to have him signed. Becky had on a Harley Quinn costume. And all of a sudden, I turn around and he's like, you know, can I draw your daughter dressed like Harley Quinn? This is amazing. And took a bunch of pictures. And we used to go every other month to these shows where Tommy would be there. So we built this relationship up with Tommy. Just a great, great, great guy. And it's sad because over the years we have seen the decline of the health, and he lost his sight for a few years. He lost use of an arm. He had an amputation. It has just been horrible and tragic and so sad. And the saddest part, like you were saying, is he's been a freelance artist other than that first year we met him when he was a DC exclusive. He's been insurance free. Like you have to pay for your own.
Right.
And when you're paying for your own, you're not getting the best at what you can get. You're getting what you can afford. And this is such a tough thing. And watching his wife try to get through this it's awful. It's awful because this is her husband.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, it really hurts.
I mean, not to go down the politics route, but I remember reading an article the other day, and I don't know the exact number, but I want to say that it said that over 50% of the money raised on GoFundMe, which is another,
yep,
site, over 50% of the money raised in the past year, or even multiple years, I think it might have been, was to pay for medical expenses.
That is devastating.
So when you live in a country such as we do and people have to crowdfund to pay for their health care, that's real sobering.
Yeah.
And I think when you have people that are close to you or people that you know that are affected by that, it's very difficult to even fathom that situation. You know what I mean? So, but anyways, go to the Facebook page and go and post your words of support. And, you know, if I would say don't watch the update from Samantha, but when you watch the update from Samantha, you will marvel at what an amazingly courageous and strong person that she is. Yeah. Like, it just blows me away, because she has really been just an absolute rock throughout all of this. So, yeah, man, tough stuff there. And just really also affecting when it's someone who is like your age.
Yeah.
It's just like unbelievable. So, okay, deep breath.
Yep.
Because we do too many of these on this show. Because we want to talk about some comics, Matthew. But before we talk about some comics, we do have to mention our sponsors, who are VikingOilsLLC.com. Now, I noticed that as we record this, we are about to head into Father's Day. As you listen to this, it will be after Father's Day. There is currently a 15% discount that's being offered through VikingOilsLLC.com. If you go to their Facebook page, you can follow them on Instagram. If you go to the website, you can get 15% off right now. I'm not sure how long this particular discount is going to last, but what I will tell you is that if you are following them on Facebook, if you are following them on Instagram, there are discounts all the time.
Yes.
There are updates on the new seasonal products that are coming along. There are updates. I just read one the other day where he was talking about how the business has grown mm-hmm. over the past couple of years from when he was selling these products in tiny, tiny little bottles. And now it's become a full-grown business for him. So, you know, we've always had relationships with kind of smaller mom and pop, you know, sort of entities on this show. And I think that for us, I mean, everybody knows I use Viking Oils all the time.
Yes.
So, you know, to see that he's doing really well and to have their support on the show is really great. So, you know, if the discount for the 15% for the Father's Day stuff is not currently on, keep your eye on that page because there's always discounts that come along and updates and new products and everything like that. But VikingOilsLLC.com is where you can keep up to date with the most information.
And it was fun getting the code for us to put up. It's Masked Men 15, which plays in with Secret Identity.
Sure, it absolutely
does. So we
love
that. That was really good.
And we absolutely appreciate that. So, yeah, go check it out, VikingOilsLLC.com. And that brings us, Matthew, to the time of day where we talk about comic books. And you're going to start us off today with a series that features, I would say, a character that most people are familiar with.
Yeah, it's a guy who wears a black mask, a black everything, and carries a red lightsaber, which plays a lot into this. And this is Darth Vader, the latest of the series from Star Wars. Now, this is, I believe, is the second or third that Marvel has done. Actually, it might be the – Marvel did a 25-issue series. It ended. And then I think they might have done one or two onesies. I'm trying to think. And this one. But if not – what I've been really excited about was towards the end of the run of the original Darth Vader series.
Yep,
I was starting to think, yeah, we need to wrap this up. This isn't very good. It's not as exciting as it could be, simply because you have a character that you're not. Darth Vader is not a limited character at all. He is one of the most dynamic characters. However, he doesn't talk a lot, and his actions speak louder than anything else.
I would argue that Darth Vader is a character that you don't want to overuse.
Yes.
Because he has such an impact, especially like in the movies and stuff like that, when he shows up, that he steals the scene.
Absolutely.
You know, he steals the momentum from the entire kind of storyline. And so you want to use him to punctuate mm-hmm. situations. When you have to draw out very long storylines with him, then it starts to lose some of its punch.
That's exactly what
it
did.
And so I think these shorter series are better to kind of focus. Now, is this a new ongoing or is this going to be a limited series? Do you know?
I am not sure. I'm hoping that it's going to be like a 4 or 5 one and done, because it almost feels like it when I talk about the story. But let's talk about the creative team right now. Charles Sewell's writing it. We know Charles can write like nobody else. One of your favorite pencilists, Brian, Giuseppe Camuncoli.
Oh, man. One of my favorite Spidey artists of all time.
Yes, he does this. He does the art in here. Cam Smith, the inks. Colorist David Sorrell. And Joe Caramagna does the letters. As
Joe
we would
Caramagna,
expect.
Eating donuts, letter and comics, talking about hockey.
So my favorite, before we even get anywhere, I think about this. We've got Plastic City Comic Con coming up next month.
Yes.
And the first one we did it with Joe. And I remember Joe. And now anytime Joe does a show, he'll always put up something that says, hey, if you bring me like some local delicacy. And
I'll pay you in comics.
Yeah, he's not looking for something rich and exciting and that. He's looking for whatever food, pastry you
he's
get
a big
that's
donut
local
guy.
To the area.
Right. If there's a if you have a local donut shop
yep.
that's not a chain, that is like a local mom and pop place that has great donuts or whatever, or great pastries or great cupcakes or whatever, he will put the word out that bring me some of that good stuff and I'll pay you back in comics.
Yeah. So the funniest thing was we got there at the show. We were talking and he was talking about getting food. And he's like, well, I'll be covered pretty soon. Somebody said they're bringing me a dozen donuts from Mrs. Murphy's. And I'm like, a dozen donuts? And he goes, yeah. Now, I think Joe is thinking, when you think of most places, you think of a dozen donuts from Dunkin' Donuts. If you really tried, you can eat them in a sitting.
Sure.
There's not a lot to them. Mrs. Murphy's donuts are probably 3 pounds a piece.
Right.
And when you
each
get that,
one is like a cake.
Yeah, when you get those things. So I'm like, I go, you're going to barely be able to get through one of these today. And he had that. So he shared the donuts with everybody. But Mrs. Murphy's, got to love them. So we start out this comic where this is literally maybe 2 or 3 weeks after we see Darth Vader in episode 3 with the armor kind of clunking around a little bit because he's got to get used to it.
Yep.
So he still has the memory of Padme dying very fresh in his mind. He still has the battle with the Emperor fresh in his mind. He still is feeling and remembering laying there legless and almost armless on the lava pit of Mullistar or Mullafar.
I have no idea.
Mustafar.
Dude. Yeah. You could have said
Bob's Discount Furniture
Blueberry
planet.
Hill, and I wouldn't have known different.
So Mustafar is the planet where he was fighting and then lost all his limbs to Obi-Wan, and Obi-Wan left him there to die. And he is still having all those thoughts. So as you see this, you see Darth Vader, like his fist starting to clench, and then you turn the page and he screams no and throws the Emperor back with the rage and anger that was in him. And the Emperor is like, this is great. And he tells – but so this is where it gets really, really good and deep. He's looking at the Emperor saying, you told me you could have saved her. And he goes, you chose a different path. I told you that Padme would not die, but you decided that you were going to do something that ended up killing her. And he keeps saying it. He's like, Padme is dead, my friend. And from that power, that's the dark side, she's dead. And he keeps reinforcing that to him. Because if you think about the things that drove Darth Vader to become Darth Vader, number one was the loss of his mother. Number two was his ego attitude and his whole just personality of wanting to be the best and wanting to not have anybody ever suffer as he did as a kid. And then losing Padme. Those are the biggest losses of his entire life. So the Emperor is just sitting there telling him, hey, you know what? You can either choose to accept this gift that you've been given, being locked in a suit of armor, or you can just die. So the choice is yours. So Darth Vader tells him, I will live. And he says, good. And then the Emperor zaps him and shocks him with that lightning power that he has. And he goes, Vader, where's your lightsaber? The lightsaber that you had when you were fighting Obi-Wan, where is it? And he's like, Obi-Wan took it. And then he zaps him again. And he says, you know what? That blade belongs to another. A Jedi now has your lightsaber. Your weapon is now in the hands of a Jedi. Which is always interesting because I still joke around about the fact that in the scene in the episode 4, when Obi-Wan gives him the lightsaber and he starts, you know, this is your lightsaber. It belonged to your father. I'm not going to tell you that it killed a lot of little kids in a Jedi temple, but it did. So he's explaining to Darth Vader that, you know what? You lost your lightsaber. You are a Sith. And the only way now you're going to get another lightsaber is to steal one. And you need to go get it. So it's really, really interesting on this part of it where the Emperor has his lightsaber, which is a red blade. And apparently the red is a Sith thing. And it is explained that it is the certain bloodstone that they use to put in there. Hmm. Like they use a crystal to channel the blade. Here they use a stone that gives off a red hue, which represents the blood of the Sith. So he's like, you know what? So here's the deal. You're going to have to go find yourself a new lightsaber. And Darth Vader's like, how am I going to do that? All the Sith are gone. All the Jedi are gone. And the Emperor's like, no, you know what? I think I got an idea. I think we can do something. So the next page, you have this huge delegation all getting together. And there's like this fire pit looking thing. And if you remember in the Phantom Menace and even in the other two in the prequels, sort of the second in command of the council is that big dude he's blue. And he's got like the two tendrils that hang down that have spikes at the end. I'll show you who it is because you'll recognize from the picture.
Oh, yeah.
But he's sort of the emperor's right-hand man. He's like the vice emperor. And he's
The vice emperor.
He's talking about how the Jedi turned on us and did all this bad stuff. And look what happened. And thankfully, we wiped them all out. And what he has is he's got a bunch of stormtroopers that bring in a huge bucket full of lightsabers. And it's all the dead Jedi's lightsabers from Order 66 after they killed them all.
Right.
They picked up their lightsabers and put them in a collection.
Yeah, they're not going to leave them there.
Nope. So the Emperor is looking over going, hey, do you see this? He goes, the crystals from a Jedi's lightsaber is going to do. That's going to work. That is how you are going to do this. And then they're like, never again are the Jedi ever going to corrupt anything ever again. And they dump all the lightsabers into like this flame and in this big ceremony, tip it up, and then they all burn and are destroyed. So Darth Vader's sort of looking like, huh, I thought I was going to get one of those lightsabers. So you're seeing how the Emperor is just toying with them, playing with them, pulling at his emotions. And as the lightsabers are burning, the Emperor is saying, you understand, Lord Vader, right? And he goes, yeah, I need to get another one of those lightsabers because those are all corrupt. And I'm going to have to go get another one. So all the lightsabers just whoosh out. And next time you see Darth Vader, he and the Emperor are on a shuttle heading towards the mid-rim. You have the outer rim, which is Tatooine and all that stuff. You've got the center of the galaxy, which is Coruscant. And here's the mid-rim. So you're only a little bit out. You're only midway out, which is why it's called the mid-rim. And as they get out there, the Emperor is saying, well, you know what? I think you're going to have a little bit of success finding your lightsaber here. And it's a desert world. And he's telling them, you need to find a lightsaber from a Jedi. There's a Jedi out here hiding. And as he starts walking down the gangplank, he's saying, next time I see you, you better have a lightsaber. And then the plank goes up and the ship leaves. And Darth Vader is sitting there just looking at this wasteland. And as he's looking over, I'll show you too, Brian, because this is very interesting. You have you actually see him control the lenses that he uses when he's out there. So for three panels, for three panels, you are getting what he sees. And he's looking out and everything is flaming red. He clicks something on his belt and all of a sudden the lens almost turns into like sunglasses. So he's able to see and he just starts walking. And as he's walking a little bit, he comes across a ship that is definitely a Sith ship. And these two dudes are over there. They're junk dealers. And they're like, man, we can get a lot of money for this one. This is going to be great. This is going to be a great year for us. And before the guy can even finish it, he gets like crushed by this huge piece of metal.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, as soon as he says, this is going to be a great year for us. This is the year of us.
Ever say that.
No. It isn't.
Yeah, so the guy's laying there with like this big piece of metal crushed on him. And Darth Vader, then he throws the body down there. Darth Vader grabs another guy, whips him down. And the guy's like, what do you want? And he's like, from you? I don't want anything.
I just wanted to mess with you guys.
Only this. And then you just see him destroy everybody. And that is how this issue ends. So I believe this was a double size issue, $4.99. Fantastic, fantastic story. And there's a backup story, Brian. We have a few pages in here by our good friends, Chris Eliopoulos and Jordy Belair.
Oh.
So they do a thing called No Good Deed.
That's a dream team. I'm guessing, is this a stylized Chris Eliopoulos type comic?
So you got that little wheelie droid on the Death Star, you know, the one that just goes around in wheels, a little small thing, a box.
Yep.
And it's going in there, and Darth Vader's going, oh, droid, prepare my meditation chamber. So as soon as he's getting ready, all of a sudden an officer comes up and says, oh, hey, Lord Vader, just got to let you know that, you know, it's going to take us longer than expected to do what we needed to do. And he's like, oh, so you're disappointing me. I don't like excuses. And then you see the guy grab his throat and he falls down and dies. And then he tells the robot, can you prepare my chamber, please? And then all of a sudden an officer comes to the door and says, hey, Lord Vader, just to let you know, we were supposed to get a lot more troops, but we only got half of what we were supposed to get. And he's like, oh, so this is your report? It's not to my liking. And apparently living isn't to your liking either. And then he chokes and kills that guy. And then he tells the droid to get rid of the body. So droid drags the body out, comes back in. And all of a sudden the door opens up again and it is another officer. And he starts out with, we have a slight problem. And he goes, we do not have a problem. You have the problem. And the officer's trying to tell him that the freighter that they were going to get ready is not prepared. And then he ends up dying. So the droid has to take him out. And then when he tries to get in the chamber, the droid is like stuck or something and can't get past something. And he's like, can you prepare my chamber? Prepare the chamber. And then Darth Vader, you see like off camera, it goes chomp scrunch. And then he sits down in his the hibernation chamber and goes, at last. So great fun. A really good book. I'm really hoping they're going to keep this as a miniseries because this story could be a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, and eventually he's got to find that lightsaber, right?
Yep.
I mean, for crying out loud. All right, well, we are going to jump over to Simple Comics now, Matthew. You and I went to the first annual
yes.
CT GamerCon a little while back. And at that Connecticut GamerCon, we saw our good buddy Matt Ryan, of course, of Free Lunch Comics. And with him there was Chris Fizikas, who you're going to hear in our creator spotlight in a little while here on this show. Chris of Simple Comics has a book called The Last, which I'm going to talk about today. He is the creator and the writer of this, and Matt Ryan did the pencils and inks on this one, of course. So, you know, us being familiar with Matt's style,
yeah,
that kind of made me feel right at home with this book. But as you'll hear with the conversation that I had with Chris a little bit later, we are both Mass Effect fans. We are both kind of fans of immersive worlds and big stories and kind of role-playing game stuff. And so I knew I was going to like this book as soon as I started it. And we start off on a planet called Grandir, where you have a guy who is kind of a cross between an orc and a minotaur. And that's what this particular race of beings looks like. And they have sort of a primitive village that's on this planet of Grandir. And this guy's name is Krayoitu. At least that's how I'm pronouncing it. And Krayoitu is the kind of leader of this group. And his wife's name is Lakila. And his son's name is Brantu. And a lot of this book is about Krayoitu, who is saying to Brantu, like, you have to learn how to go on watch, son. You have to learn. I'm training you to be, you know, the person that sort of protects this village. I'm training you in how to keep watch. I'm training you in how to patrol. I'm training you in how to do this. And so he spends a lot of time kind of training his son. And his son has grown up on this planet, but doesn't really know a lot about, like, how they came to be there or why they're there or anything like that. And he's always wondering why his father is looking up to the stars. And you come to find out a little bit later, and it's because these guys have not always been on this planet. That Krayoitu was the general of basically a race of beings that went around the galaxy and were spreading technology and knowledge around, and they were kind of explorers. And what ended up happening is at one point in time, they went to a planet that was not happy to see them. It was a kind of a very warlike planet, and this warlike planet essentially started to attack them and attacked their whole fleet and basically drove them halfway across the galaxy to where there was very few of them left, and they crash landed on this planet. And so this guy, Krayoitu, was a general, and he led these people. And when very few of them were left and they crashed on this planet, they decided to build a life here because it was sort of out of the way of this particular, I'm trying to see the name of the army, the Gulgar. So the Gulgar sort of lost track of these guys when they crashed on this planet. And so Krayoitu decided, we're going to settle here. We're going to build a village here. We're going to live a life here. And we're going to stay off the radar. And hopefully these guys will never find us. But he's always looking to the skies because he's waiting for that one day that these guys are going to appear again, the Gulgar. And so you see that this history is not a history that he ever shared with his son. And so one night he goes out on patrol with his son and he decides to share this history with him and explain to him, but he doesn't tell his son that he was the general. He doesn't tell his son that basically he's the hero of this people. He just tells him, this is what happened to our people. You know, we crashed here and this is why we're here. And he's telling him, I have a gift for you. And he gives him what almost looks like a little USB drive. And you saw in earlier pages that Krayoitu has sort of a lab down beneath where they live. And he has kind of a little spherical robot buddy who is kind of bonded to his particular genetic code. And what it seems like is happening is he is preparing this little robot drone to sort of be transferred over to his son because he's knowing that someday he's either going to pass on or something bad's going to happen, and he wants his son to sort of have this thing because not only is it a tool, but it's a weapon as well. And so he's explaining all of this stuff to his son, and he's saying, you know, I'm telling you this because one day you may have to use this knowledge. And while they're having this conversation, the village gets attacked because the Gulgar have found them. And when they arrive here, they are using these sort of robot mercenaries to do their dirty work. And so they show up to the village, they start trashing the place, they start killing everybody, and Kroyoitu decides that he is going to stand and fight, and he sends his son Brantu away and says, go get your mother, you guys have to get out of here, we have to get off this planet, I'm going to hold these guys off, but there's no hiding from them. And so his mother, who is also a warrior, she takes up arms against this army that's coming in, and she's fighting them. At one point, the father and son sort of get away because the father has to get the son to a place where he can kind of hide him away in the secret lab in the basement and says, you need to stay here. I'm going to go back out. I'm going to fight with your mother. We're going to get rid of all these guys. And when we do, we're going to get out of here. But you cannot leave here. You have to stay down here. And of course, as kids are often wont to do, he doesn't listen.
They don't listen.
And he follows out. And what he finds out when he gets up there is that his mother's been killed. And his father, who now is in sort of a berserker rage, is just throwing himself at this army against numbers that are completely overwhelming. And so what happens is his father ends up getting taken. And so once that happens, you have Brantu, who is here and is realizing that his mother's dead and his father's been taken away. And the only way that the situation is going to change is if he takes it upon himself to find a way off this planet and to go after his father and to save his father, because the rest of the village has been completely destroyed at this point. And so he takes this little sort of USB drive looking thing, and it starts speaking to him. And this little droid shows up and says, and he says, oh, hello, Brantu. And he's like, what the heck are you? Well, I'm a weapon. I'm integrated lifeline. You can call me Will. I need you to take that little USB drive thing, and I need you to sort of inject yourself with it. And then it's going to bond the two of us, and you'll see that I'll be able to help you. And so as soon as he does that, he starts to feel stronger, and he's able to punch a hole through the wall, and he realizes that the bond that he now has with this thing gives him some physical powers. And so once he realizes that he has that, that sort of solidifies the idea that he is going to go after this army, and he's going to hunt them down, and he's going to find his father. And that's the way the first issue sort of ends, with him burying his mom and realizing, I'm getting out of here, and we're going after my father. And so there's a lot of ground that gets covered in this first issue. And what I liked about it was that I think that Chris does an excellent job of building this world where these, you know, this particular group of beings has now made a life for themselves. You don't know a ton about their history or their culture or anything like that, but you pick up little bits and pieces there. But he gives you enough to know that this is, you know, these are sort of the last of this particular, you know, race of people. And now they get attacked. And really, this kid and his father are now the only ones left. And so it's this father-son story where normally in these types of situations, both parents get killed and the son's the only one left and he has to become the hero. And in this one, he's going after his father. And so I kind of like that was a little twist on what you would usually expect from this story. Of course, Matt Ryan's pencils and inks are fantastic, and the book looks absolutely great. And in the back of it, you not only get a letter from Chris about the origins of this particular series, but you also get a couple of short fiction pieces that add to the world. And I love when creators do stuff like that. I remember with Anthony Johnston's Wasteland.
Yes.
He used to always have those sort of journal entries in the back that would tell you more about the world and tell you more about the travels of, you know, a ruin runner and stuff like that. And so I really, really like that this book has sort of that epic feel to it and makes you want to learn more about that particular world. So really, really good first issue. I'm definitely looking forward to checking out the rest of the series. And Simple Comics is the name of the publisher. I know you can go to freelunchcomics.com because they are working with them, and you can find out more about that. I will put a link in the show notes because I don't know what the website is for Simple Comics, but you can contact Chris at simplecomics@gmail.com if you want to find out more information about where the book is going to be. If you're around here, any of the Connecticut shows that you go to, you will see him at those shows, and you'll be able to check that out. And stay tuned for the interview that we're going to be doing shortly with him.
So, on a sad note, I'm going to talk about the last issue of a series that, to me, has been probably one of my favorite series in the last couple of years.
And surprisingly, right? Because this was one of those Hanna-Barbera reboots that when we first heard about them, what, a year ago now?
Yep.
It was kind of like, are you serious?
Yeah.
Like when we heard that DC was going to be making these Hanna-Barbera books based on cartoons and shows that we grew up loving, we were psyched.
Yep.
Right. But then you saw that all of them, none of them were what you were going to expect them to be. all of them are going to be sort of a twist on what you thought it was going to be. And the Flintstones one, which is the one that you're going to talk about, is one that has really been more mature,
yeah,
I think, and a little bit deeper than you probably would have expected it to be.
Yeah, if you like politics and religion and, you know, adult relationships, and I don't mean sexually, but all those things in there, this book is exactly
right,
what
it's hitting some it big is, issues.
It is amazing. And this book is a serious commentary on us as a society and where we are in 2017.
Uh-huh.
I was blown away by the first couple issues, and every issue just seemed to be getting deeper and deeper. And just to tell you, too, that they sometimes tend to knock religion a little bit in here. And instead of me being offended by that, because, you know, they kind of make fun of the whole God concept, and instead of me getting upset and angry about it, I looked at it as, you know what, this is just brilliant storytelling. This is great writing. Even though I don't agree with certain aspects of what they're talking about,
right,
it did not at all take away from me enjoying this series at all and really calling it and thinking of it as one of my favorite series in the last couple of years. Mark Russell is the writer. Steve Pugh is the artist. And Chris Chuckery is the colorist on this one. So we start out with the Great Gazoo. That's the little green character uh-huh. that from outer space that hung around. And he's walking around Bedrock. And he's
I always think of him as like Mr. Mixoplick.
Yes, that's what he – yeah. So he's putting together this little report, and he's talking about how, you know, this was really interesting that on Earth, this Earth is only – you know, this society is only like 100 years old, 80 years old. And the people have gone from living in caves to actually having like their own places. They've got houses that they live in. They've
got work. Their version of technology.
They have everything going on for them, and he's explaining how – you know, even the religion is still a really tough concept for them to handle. And this book also does a lot of, you know, creation versus evolution. That is huge in this book. And what is really funny is that if you think about evolution, you think about evolution happening around the time of when the Flintstones would take place. None of that has taken place yet. So you still have them like, well, we're really kind of following science, as limited as it may be. So they talk about a lot of that stuff in here, but they have been created. They've created a god every three or four episodes or issues because something had happened that particular god did not get them out of. So they're like, all right, well, you know,
so they
what?
Move on.
What about this god? We'll just have this god. This god will really help us out. Now you've got this professor who is talking about science and how we got to do things. And he's explaining that, you know, science is just the way it is. But science is such a new concept that you don't quite know anything. Like, we have nothing to draw back on because if you do a science experiment today, you're that's it. You did it today. There's nothing to fall back on going, well, what about 20, you know, 100 years ago when somebody did this? He's explaining how things are built. And as he is, you see all these kids playing on a jungle gym made out of dinosaur bones. And then some kid comes over and smashes it with a hammer and all the kids fall off of it. And he's just explaining how that is the way things are. It's trial and error with this stuff. So we have Mr. Slate, who got broken up with by his last girlfriend, and he's devastated. So he was ready to start pulling funding out of everything. And the news report is talking about how Bedrock's Children's Hospital is now reopening because they were going to close it because they just didn't have enough money. So they said, you know what, we'll just get rid of the sick kids. Send the sick kids out in the woods and let them fend for themselves, which is a commentary on certain things that we have going on with the way that we treat people that are sick or that they're disabled. But then you see that Mr. Slate has sort of had a change of heart. So he opens up a place, and this is where it's really interesting, because this place that he opens up is for the sick children, but it's called Slate's Home for Subpar Children. Like, you see how it's like,
right,
I'm here to help these kids, and my name's on it, but, you know, he just doesn't quite get it because he's so self-absorbed. But now you see that he's trying to get his girlfriend back, who plays on a bowling team called the Spare Ribs, and they're playing against his team that is guys that are Fred Flintstone and dudes from the quarry. So he's like, Fred, if we win, I'm going to get my girlfriend back. And if we win, I'm going to make you foreman. And that seems to be a lot of this whole series too, is putting that carrot in front of Fred for everything.
Right.
Which is a lot of what we do as humans. You know what?
But didn't the show do that a lot too? Wasn't he always getting promised a promotion in the show? I can't.
Yeah,
I think he. I think that was a thing.
Was a lot of that. There was in the movie. If you remember the first movie, which I did not think was that bad. But he's like, hey, so here's the deal. If we win, you get to be a foreman. If not, you're not going to get the job. So now you've got Betty, or you've got Wilma and Pebbles in the other room. And she's like, well, I'm going off to do some science stuff. I'm going to go to the Young Scientist Club and we're going to go hang out. And her friend that she's riding her bike with to the Young Science Club, they're talking all about this. Well, what about religion? I don't understand this. It's not another kid. It's Bam Bam. So Bam Bam is kind of on that. But what about this God? What about God who created everything? And she's on the side of science saying, I need to have proof that there's a God. So I need science to prove that there's a God. And he's saying, but isn't science enough, seeing science enough to prove there is a God? And you're seeing that within a relationship of two young kids, they're having this. So then we go over. And now, to be honest, too, I did not know that this was going to be the last episode until I come to the next page where it is all the animals that are the appliances are all in a closet together, all talking about what's going on. And you have the armadillo who's doing push-ups and getting all buff, and he's upset because the last armadillo that he was friends with was taken away. It was an old bowling ball. So Wilma threw it out, and he's all been out of shape. This is never going to happen to me again. I'm going to exact my revenge on these people. So they're all like, hey, what are you doing? I don't know what you're doing. You're kind of doing something stupid. He's like, you know what? You know, I'm going to do whatever I'm going to do. I'm not living their life anymore. I'm living mine. And then you see him doing push-ups and he's doing all this stuff and all the other, you know, like one of the animals looks at the other one and goes, what do you think of this? He goes, I don't. I'm the washing machine. So then you go over. Now you're back. You see the scientist teaching things. You've got the bowling tournament that goes on, which the Flintstones lose. Fred's team loses because when he goes to throw his ball, and I'll show you, Brian, the ball unrolls and becomes this angry, pissed off armadillo that starts attacking everybody in the bowling alley.
And he was just waiting for his moment.
Yeah. And he's biting people and he says, blank you all, and then tears off out of the bowling alley. So then Mr. Slate's going, what was that all about? And Fred's like, I don't know what it was about, but we just lost because my ball never made it down the lane to knock over all the pins. So you see this guy who's one of the preachers who's kind of creating God in his image explaining that, you know what, until I am proven different, this is what I'm going to believe. You see everybody outside talking about things and how all this stuff is going to happen. You've got Fred who is taking his ball and putting it into the – he got the ball back. He's putting it into the garage to put it away with all sorts of stuff that's cleaning. And you see the armadillo talking, and all of a sudden he sees a pink elephant. And the pink elephant is explaining, you know, hey, I'm the vacuum cleaner. He was friends with the old bowling ball who was very upset that bowling ball got thrown away. So the two of them now have a friendship. And as I'm reading this, I'm like, oh, that's a nice little way to tie it up. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
We're tying everything up.
Right.
So then you have Wilma or Pebbles go in and she goes and has a heart-to-heart with the guy, the preacher, the pastor of this place. He's explaining things to him. And you're seeing that both of them, after they discuss each other's points, walk away with an understanding of each other. And it isn't an antagonistic understanding. It is a, you know what? You believe what you want. I'm not going to force it on you. I believe what I want. I'm not going to force it on you. But you know what? We should commend each other for having such deep beliefs in what we believe in. And I'm reading that going, yeah, why don't we just make copies and give this to the rest of the world?
So if I'm not mistaken, basically the message of this book is that in order for the discourse of our society to return to reasonable places, we have to go back to the Stone Age.
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah, throw some bowling balls.
Yep.
So, and then he explains to her that he wants to and needs to believe that Gerald is the God that they've made. He goes, I need to believe that there's something out there because I lost my mother and I need to believe that I'm going to see her again. And I'm reading this going, holy crap, this is like ripping me apart. So he goes, so as you can see, this God is real to me because it needs to be real.
Right.
Then you've got all this stuff and they have the first church of Gerald. And it says Gerald doesn't rub it in. So they're starting to put what my church does, like the little things like, hey, you know, God doesn't take Sundays off and, you know, all those little things
underneath. On the sign outside the church, like just a little reminders.
So he wanted to make a sign that says Gerald doesn't rub it in, and he can't make it fit. So a guy looks at him and goes, well, why don't you just abbreviate it? So it was G-D. So now you're almost getting Gerald and turning it into the word
right.
God. He doesn't rub it in. He doesn't rub it out. So you've got that. Then you've got Fred back at work, and he's now the whatchamacallit, he's now the foreman. And as the Great Gazoo is winding down this story, he's saying how he really thinks that this society here can really make something out of themselves. But because they're so primitive, because we've already had a couple alien issues, especially when Booster Gold showed up.
Right.
He says, I need to do something to protect these people, to keep everybody else away. So he creates this boundary around the Earth that no matter what angle you come at, you get this big red alien scary face.
That scares away anybody who might be coming to cause us harm.
Yeah, it says, welcome to Earth, now leave. So he says, I think everybody's going to be fine. And then you have the last issue, the last page, where every character in here is saying goodbye to you.
Huh.
And that is how this issue
now,
ends.
Now, I wonder, was it designed to only go 12 issues or was it canceled?
That's the thing. I don't know if it was canceled. I always thought it was only planned as a 6-issue.
Uh-huh.
So after it started going further, I'm like, all right, I got more.
Yep.
The way that we read and see a lot of books and how you'll be reading something, because you've had a lot of books canceled recently.
Spider-Woman is the one that really hurts that I can think of from recently.
And you read these and you start to see as the story is winding down that they are forcing endings on things just to clear the slate. And this one really seemed to have everything wrapped up very nice and tidy, especially like with a bowling ball. That was such a small part of the overall story, but it was such a great issue that story needed to be revisited and ended and brought back. So a lot of fun with this one. I know they've collected the first 6 issues of every one of the series in hardcovers. This is the one you need to go out and get. This one was fantastic.
Well, there you go, Matthew.
Yep.
Those are our new books for this week. And now it is time for us to turn our attention to the Case Files, because it is the Summer of Dread, and we are delving further into the complete Case Files Volume 1 of Judge Dredd. We are going to start off tonight with a game show, Matthew.
We love game shows. You bet your life.
I mean, Let's Make a Deal,
yep.
Wheel of Fortune, Family Feud. What was the one with the whammies?
Oh, that was Press Your Luck.
Press Your Luck,
I was
Matthew.
A big Card Sharks fan.
Card Sharks. Holy crap.
I used to have a deck of those cards.
Wow,
Card Sharks. I had a deck of Card Shark cards. Helen Gallagher, they were like $10.
Those were the golden years, weren't they?
Yep.
When we just had tons of game shows.
Yep.
And I mean, just simple entertainment, innocent entertainment, like the show that we're going to talk about in the comic tonight, which is called You Bet Your Life.
Yes. Now, the interesting thing with this story here, other than the fact that it becomes a full issue a few years later in an issue of Judge Dredd, the British love their game shows. And other than the Japanese crazy game shows that we always see the trailers of and previews of, the British have always had some very interesting game shows. So game shows are a big staple.
And we copy a lot of their game shows, and we bring them over here, and then we pretend like they're new ideas.
Yeah, so game shows are a huge part of British history.
Yep. So this show is called You Bet Your Life, and it starts off with a guy saying, hello, quiz fans, and welcome to You Bet Your Life, Mega City's only TV show where contestants risk life and limb for super duper cash prizes. I'm your host, Baby Bob Nicely.
Yes.
So Baby Bob Nicely is hosting a show that Walter, Judge Dredd's robot.
His favorite show.
Yes, is watching. And Judge Dredd comes over to him and says, what are you doing? This show's illegal. These type of game shows are absolutely illegal, and they're being put on TV by basically pirate television stations. Turn it off right now. And Walter's like, but it's my favorite show. And Judge Dredd is like, turn it off. And then he thinks of it again and says, you know what? People are getting killed on that show. Why don't we put your monitor to good use and you can help me try to crack this underground game show ring.
And what a great picture of Judge Dredd, Walter on the Law Rider.
Right. So you've got Judge Dredd and Walter riding around Mega City, and he's using Walter to track down where this underground studio is. And they end up finding it, I think, in like a sewer area or something like that. But as they're racing to this place, because Judge Dredd is basically saying, look, every second that we don't find these guys, somebody's going to die on that show. And as you might imagine, you're seeing each one of the family members. And it starts off with the poor grandmother, where it says, if Sheldon answers this question wrongly, Granny will be transported to a plutonium mine in Mutant Land.
Yes.
And of course, he gets the question wrong. And the best part is, Bob, the game show host, says, okay, Sheldon, here's your question for 10,000 credits or a nasty end for Granny. Who was the 53rd president of the United States? I'll give you a little clue. Try President Bates. And so Sheldon's like, okay, well, I'll say President Bates. Wrong. Granny's gets hauled off to the plutonium mine. So now she's off. The next thing you know, you have you fast forward to the part where his wife Penelope is going to get 10,000 credits or the prize in the mystery box.
And sadly, she took the prize in the mystery box,
which was a giant poisonous spider that bites her and kills her immediately. So like the whole entire family is dead, and we're down to the part where Sheldon is the last one left, and he has to face the guillotine.
Yeah, and it's a spelling contest. It's like, hey, you know what? I'm going to give you a word, and you need to spell the word. And it's a made-up word.
Yeah, it's Glinkspittle.
Yeah, and as Walter, Sheldon's trying to spell it, you see the thought bubble of the game show host going, he's never going to spell it. I just made up this word. I can say whatever it is I want. And lo and behold, that is pretty much what is going to happen. The guillotine starts to fall. Judge Dredd and Walter come in saving the day. By getting him off, but they blow up the blade of the guillotine.
Yes, Judge Dredd shoots the blade of the guillotine and it flies off, shattering into two pieces and killing the host and co-host of the show. And he is quip at the end, you played your own game of Bet Your Life nicely and lost. No way you could win playing against the law.
There we go. What a lesson.
It's hard not to do the snarl when you read those lines there. So the next one we go to, there's a place called the Dream Palace, and it is a place where people can pay money to go in and sit down and essentially go in like a virtual reality machine where the things that they dream about seem very real to them.
And this one is probably my favorite of the ones that we read today. This one also, too, when you start thinking about this, think about some of the movies that would come out 10 years later.
Well, I think of things like Dreamscape.
Dreamscape, and then Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Total Recall.
Total Recall.
Yeah, right. So you have this guy who goes in there, and he is I think his name is John Nobody.
John Nobody.
So he goes in there, and he uses this machine to plan out in a very meticulous fashion essentially terror attacks that he is taking implementing against people. And so he goes in here once a week and he plans it out. He like lives through whatever the thing is that he's trying to do. And so then you go over to, you know, Justice Headquarters, and we're seeing that there's been like three different attacks, and we know that something else is going to be happening soon, and we have to figure out what's going to happen. So Judge Dredd ends up going down to the Dream Palace, and he finds out that this guy that there is a staff person there who is saying that there's been a guy coming in here and he's been using like what we call the nightmare mode of this particular machine, which is like the most extreme, you know, violent sort of things that you could imagine. And this person's been using it. And we think that it might be the person that's committing all of these horrible acts. And so the only way to find out is Judge Dredd has to go in and relive the video of whatever this guy was dreaming about. And so he goes into this machine in the Dream Palace and he lives through the fact that this guy is going to attack the, I believe it's the Justice Parade.
Yes.
The Justice Day Parade, which is essentially a parade to all the judges where they have a giant judge statue and they have all the judges walking and all the judges riding on their motorcycles and stuff like that. And so he sees that there's going to be a major attack at this thing and he says, holy crap, we have to stop it because that's happening today. And so he ends up going down to the parade. The parade's just getting underway. And this guy shows up and he's dropping napalm on the judges that are walking the streets. But luckily, Judge Dredd ends up getting to this guy before he can attack too many of the other judges. And the little car pod thing that he was driving, they crash into the giant float, which is the big statue of a judge. And as this guy gets out of the pod and he starts to escape, the sword of justice that the judge was holding, this giant statue, falls out of its hand and plummets down, impaling this guy and killing him.
Yep.
And what do we get from Judge Dredd? Sweet dreams, lawbreaker. You really are nobody now. Just another punk who had to learn crime doesn't pay the hard way.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I love it. Every single one of these ends with, like, the it reminds me of Knowing is Half the Battle.
Yeah.
Except it's basically, now you're dead because you messed with the law.
Yeah.
it's the equivalent.
And the first part is going to be whatever the story was just all about.
Right. You did a stupid thing, and now you're dead because you messed with the law.
You don't stuff too many marshmallows in because they stuff you.
Right.
Stuff like that. Just
exactly.
Whatever it is, that's what's going to happen.
Play with knives, you're going to get cut by the law.
And this was this other one is another one of my favorites. And this is one, too, that a few years later, we're going to see a fully developed story about how the judges, because in this story, you have Judge Dredd, who is being told, hey, you know what? We've got graduating going on right now. You were the class of 79, 2079, Judge Dredd. So you need to go, and every time there's a graduating class, a judge will basically take on a protege.
Right. You take on a rookie protege.
The best one of the group.
And Judge Dredd gets assigned to this rookie protege who is Cadet Giant. And Cadet Giant, his father was a star athlete.
Like a basketball player, as close as you can
and
get
so
to that.
You, but Cadet Giant wanted to join the cadets. He wanted to go into law enforcement. And so he has, you know, come through the academy and done really well. And now he gets assigned to Judge Dredd. And so the is it the grand judge? I forget what his name is. But he basically says, you know, we're assigning you to Judge Dredd, and here's your new Cadet Dredd. And so, of course, Cadet Giant reaches out his hand. Oh, it's such an honor. Dredd ignores it.
Yep.
I know that name from somewhere, rookie. Oh, yeah, my father used to be the captain of the Harlem Heroes. Oh, okay, yeah, I remember him. Shut up and get on your bike, and we're going to go stop a crime now, and I'm going to basically be evaluating you out in the field. So they go out into the field, and there's this group called the Futsies, who are people who are so overwhelmed with the pace of the future that they essentially go into a berserker rage and just kill everybody. So they're just people that can't handle the level of technological advancement and the pace of life in this current day and age.
Future shock.
Yeah, future shock. There you go, Matthew. And so so they go out and they're going to stop these guys because this guy's walking around murdering people with an axe. And so Cadet Giant is supposed to, you know, Dredd says, well, go do what you're supposed to do, man. Go in and take care of stuff. So Dredd goes around one side of the building. This guy goes around one side of the building. Cadet Giant opens the door. He gets the drop on this bad guy, and he's got his gun, but his hand's shaking as he's telling this guy to freeze. And the door in the back gets kicked open, and he fires. And he ends up firing at Judge Dredd and hitting him dead square in the middle of the head. Yeah. Luckily, his helmet stopped the bullet from killing him.
Yeah.
And Dredd has to pull out his gun and take down this berserker before the guy gets away. So the mission could not have gone more poorly for Cadet Giant. And Dredd's like, well, I'm going to have to fail you because, I mean, you almost killed me and you did a terrible job and you're not a good cadet, and basically reads him the riot act. And all of a sudden, as they're kind of talking, they get another call over the radio. Oh, we've got something happening. There's a kidnapping. And Cadet Giant says, give me one more chance. Just give me one more chance. I'll do my best. I will change your opinion of me. And of course, they go down to the Sector 3, where it is the Heroes Bowl, where it's sort of like the arena that this sport was played in.
Yeah.
And there's like statues and everything to this kid's father, to Cadet Giant's father, because he was a star and all this kind of stuff. But it's an area that Cadet Giant is familiar with because he used to see his dad play here and everything. So he kind of knows the lay of the land, and he gets in there and he ends up basically putting his life on the line to stop this kidnapper, and ends up stopping him before he can kill this kid. And he saves his kid. He wears a jetpack like his father used to wear back in his playing days. And he ends up swooping in and saving this kid at the last minute. And so Cadet Giant ends up getting the pass from Judge Dredd. And they go to the ceremony where this kid ends up getting his full badge, because you get like a half badge. Half the shield, and you have to wear a white helmet.
Yep.
And then you graduate to the black helmet and the full shield if you make it through, you know, whatever trials you're supposed to go through. And so, but then the story, and these stories are brutal, because you have the father show up and he's like, oh, son, you know, your dad's proud of you. Come on home. We're going to have a big party. And the son's like, sorry, dad, you'll have to hold the party without me. Duty calls. I'm a judge now.
Yeah. So
apparently, as soon as you turn into a judge, you're a jerk.
And they explain that in the thing. They take you away when you're a little kid.
Yeah.
Your parents put you into this thing, and there was a guy. One of my favorite scenes in this was when this kid is like out there on his lawbreaker bike or the lawgiver, whatever one the motorcycle is, and he's like standing up shooting these things, and then he makes a mistake and something happens, and Judge Dredd's like, "Wow, 12 years of this guy's life right out the toilet. He's gonna get kicked out."
Yeah.
Wait, what?
Right. And so here you have a silhouette of basically the kid turning his back on his father and walking away forever.
Yeah.
And Judge Dredd's like, hey, you know, never mind, Citizen Giant. Look at it this way. You've lost a son, but Mega City has gained a darn fine judge.
Yeah.
That's how it ends.
I feel so much better.
Well, then I guess everything's okay now.
Maybe I'll stand completely upright
again.
Turned
his back on me. Yeah, it was perfect. So then we go to the next story, which features a group called the Neon Knights, who are an anti-robot sort of racist group that have started attacking robots on the streets. They wear these crosses and they wear hoods. I mean, clearly they're metaphor for the KKK,
yes,
obviously. So these guys come in and they're attacking robots on the street. Every time they see an isolated robot walking home at night or something like that, these guys show up in their costumes and start beating the crap out of them. And Judge Dredd is investigating this assault that happened on a robot. And he sees these three guys, you know, hanging around on the corner. And he's like, well, did you guys see anything? Nope, we didn't see anything. But, you know, who cares? It was only a dirty robot, you know, blah, 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 blah. Of course, those are the guys that, you know, that are underneath the mask as you sort of read on. But what happens is poor Walter is walking home one night. And Walter is a free robot. So Walter can walk the streets. He can do whatever he wants to do. He's been granted his freedom. And he's walking home one night and he's trying to make it home. And he gets accosted by these three guys. And so they beat the ever-living crap at him. They smash his monitor. Meanwhile, at the same time, Judge Dredd is at Mega City's Hightower Cemetery. Apparently they have enough judges getting killed on the streets that they have a Hightower Cemetery.
Yes.
And he's paying his respects to like five different judges that have recently been killed. And all of a sudden, he sees on the monitor that there's something going on, and he goes outside and he finds out that Walter is about to be executed by this group. And he shows up and he's like, "What the heck are you guys doing?" And they sort of grab him and they bring him to their lead guy, and they're like, "Oh, we found him spying on him." And the leader of the group is like, "You know, he's the one that saved us from the machines. He's probably going to be on our side. Why don't you join us, Judge Dredd?" And Dredd's like, "Well, I know this robot, and he's my robot, so if anybody's going to kill him, it should probably be me." And the guy's like, "Oh, that's a great idea," and hands him this giant sword. And, of course, Dredd turns on the rest of them. And they're like, "Oh, he's trying to escape. You know, don't let him get out of here." And he says to them, "I ain't escaping. I'm taking you all on."
Yep.
And there's like 50 of them. And he just beats the living crap out of everybody. And they're like, "Oh, prepare to taste vengeance." And he shoots this guy in the face. "Oh, prepare, burn, Dredd." And he kills this guy over here. You know, and then he just absolutely rips through all of them. And he's like, "There's something you ought to know about your precious leader." And he grabs the leader of the group and pulls on his face. And the skin of the guy's face comes off because he's a cyborg.
He's a cybo, a dirty cybo.
He's a cyborg that hates himself. And because of that, started this group to basically eradicate robots. And so, of course, Dredd ends up, you know, taking him down. And then all the rest of the group surrenders and they're saying, "You're the law, Judge Dredd. You're great. You know, we love you. Sorry we followed this guy."
Yep.
And he saves the day and he saves Walter.
Yep.
And he says, and Walter's like, "Oh, thanks for, you know, doing that for me. I'm so proud." And he's like, "Not just for you, Walter. I did it for my fellow judges, too, who died upholding the law that protects robot and human alike."
Yep.
"Kind of judge would I be?"
Yep.
"If I didn't stand up for everybody under the law." So that's the end of that story. Then we get to the next story, which is called The Return of Rico. And one of the things I liked about it is it had an actual title, because most of these stories don't even have a title.
Yeah.
You just have to sort of figure out what the heck it is that the story's about. What we learn in this story is that Judge Dredd was a clone.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
And they play that up in the movie. If you remember in the Sylvester Stallone movie, he is a clone from Armand Assante's character.
Oh, I forgot that.
Yes.
Thank you for that, Matthew, because we're going to be watching that movie soon. But anyways, this guy Rico apparently was he and Judge Dredd are basically like twin clones.
Yes.
And he came up in the academy with him. But what happened is this guy Rico went bad. And I don't know if Judge Dredd thought he was dead or whatever, but the story starts with him basically showing back up to town. And you don't see his face through most of the story, but he shows back up to town. He shows up to Dredd's house and ends up assaulting the landlady there, and he ends up coming after Dredd because he's back in town now, and he's calling himself Judge Dredd because they're both basically the same person.
Yeah.
They're both clones, except one of them went really bad. So he basically shows up back in town, and his whole thing is, I'm going to kill Judge Dredd, and I'm going to be Judge Dredd. That's mm-hmm. what's happening now. So he shows up, and you get the history of them. And the history of them is that this guy Rico in the academy was a better shot than Dredd. He was a better cadet than Dredd. Dredd was always pushing himself to be as good as this guy. And so when they graduated together and they ended up getting out on the streets, turns out this guy Rico started taking bribes, and he started running a protection racket, and he started doing all of this stuff that was illegal. And Dredd ended up having to turn him in. And when he turned him in, he had to go he got 20 years on the penal colony on Titan. And so, which is basically this moon where he had to be in a mining colony. And because he was a former judge, he didn't get treated very nope. well. So he had a really tough life. And when we finally see his face, we see that he is kind of a cyborg now too, that his face is all scarred up and he's got like basically circuitry built into his face and everything so that he could survive out there, because he was out there and it took such a toll on his body when he was in this penal colony. But he's come back now and he wants his revenge. And so they end up getting to a point where they're going to have a duel.
Mm.
And Rico is sure that he's always been a faster draw than Judge Dredd. But what he didn't count on was the fact that this penal colony and all the stuff that happened to him physically has taken a toll on his body. And so when they get into the duel, Judge Dredd is the quicker draw this time, and he ends up shooting him. But instead of just leaving him there or, you know, walking away or whatever, Judge Dredd feels sympathy for this guy because they're basically the same. And he ends up scooping this guy up, and he ends up giving him like a proper burial because it's his brother. And yeah. at one point he says, he ain't heavy, he's my brother.
Yep.
And so he is going to make sure that this guy gets buried properly. And it sort of, as it ends, people are sort of marveling that, you know, you can clone somebody, you can give them all the same genetic material and everything, but they're still are going to be differences, and no one is like Judge Dredd.
Yep.
So we get that story. Then we go over to the next one, which involves Devil's Island, which if you remember, there was a guy by the name of Whitey in the second story that we read of this entire volume, where his sentence was to be put on Devil's Island, which is sort of a parking lot in the yeah. middle of the superhighway that runs around Mega City, where the sound from all of the vehicles whizzing by is like this cacophony in your ears. The traffic is so fast and furious that there is no possible way that any living being could get off of this thing without just getting crushed. And so this guy Whitey has been here for a long time, and he has figured out a way to get off of Devil's Island. And what he's done is he's got like this Einstein guy who's his cellmate, and he's had him build a weather computer from the different equipment that they've had in the workshop. And he builds this weather computer, and what he does is he uses it to manipulate the weather of Mega City 1 and decides to create a snowstorm. And when he creates a snowstorm, because this is something that never happens mm-hmm. in Mega City, you have the roads become unpassable. You have accidents all over the place. The traffic gets completely bogged down, and everything basically slows to a stop. And that's when he's able to get off of Devil's Island. So you have Dredd, who just happens to be out on patrol, and he is stuck in this snowstorm. But he realizes that the person behind this must have been someone who was trying to get off of Devil's Island. So he figures it out, and he ends up tracking this Whitey guy down. And this whole story takes place in this humongous snowstorm. And how does he end up defeating him here? Judge Dredd ends up like feigning that this guy got the drop on yep. him. And when this guy comes in for the kill, he grabs a handful of snow, whips it in the guy's eyes and blinds him. And then as soon as he does that, he grabs the weather computer away from him and turns the sun back on. And when he does that, everything melts and this guy is caught once again. And so he's going back to Devil's Island for the rest of his life.
Wah, wah.
So that brings us to the final story of our cases tonight, and that is Computel. Computel is a brand new hotel that's been opened up in Mega City, and it is a completely automated hotel. And so you have the person who's running the hotel basically opening it up saying, we don't have any staff. Everything is run automatically. All of our guests will be treated to the highest quality of service, all this kind of stuff. And the very first group of guests is being allowed in this new Computel. It's now open for business. So you have all these people going in, And as they go in, you have a couple who goes into their room, and you have sort of a robotic eatery machine that's saying, "Welcome to the bridal suite. If you wish a meal of any kind, speak your order, and it will be transported immediately into your food slot." "Oh, that's great. You know, we'll have two salads, please." "Sure, just reach your hand in here." And he reaches his hand in there, and his hand gets scorched. And he's like, "Oh, it's burning." Then the robot shuts down the door and makes it electronically charged so they can't get out of there. You see in another room or another hallway, a guy opens up the elevator and falls down the shaft because there's no elevator in it. You see in another room, the guy's taking a bath, and the shower ends up drowning him. So. You see all of these things where basically the hotel is completely turned against people, and we go back to that first room, and the husband is saying to the wife, "Look, I'm going to throw myself against the door, and I'm going to short-circuit it, and when it opens, you get the heck out of here, and you go get help." And so he basically sacrifices his life to save his wife, and when he throws himself on the electric door, it opens up. She goes out and finds the judge, and it happens to be Judge Dredd. And so he ends up finding his way into sort of the elevator, the central computer complex of the hotel, and finds out that there is a human-hating robotic intelligence that's in there. And he draws his gun on it, and he takes a shot at it, and it doesn't do anything. And he ends up what the heck did he do to it? It says, "I'll raise the temperature steadily. You have 30 seconds before your blood boils." And he's trying to get his gun free because they have magnetized his gun, and he manages to finally get his gun free, and he shoots out like the central computer system, and he ends up destroying this computer. And when he does, everybody's freed from the hotel, and outside he's saying, "You know, you'd think they'd learn by now, and this will teach them some more. Machines should serve man, not control them."
Yep.
And so you constantly are seeing this theme of the robots versus the humans, or more from more of a bird's eye view, the idea that you can't become overly reliant on technology because it could turn against you, which, again, this is stuff that's being written in the 70s and early 80s. Yeah. And here we are in 2017, and we can't do anything without electronics.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So between your Flintstone stories today and the Judge Dredd stuff that we read today, you know, the dangers of technology and the over-reliance on it are certainly themes that are very, very relevant today. But another great set of cases. Yeah. Now, your homework for this time is you were going to read the next story, which involves Walter sort of sneaking out of the house. You're going to read that story, and you're going to go all the way through the case that involves Billy Jones. That's your next chunk of cases that you're going to read for this. And then I think the show after that will probably do the first Judge Dredd, or maybe even in the next one. If we decide to do that, we'll put a thing up on the website, though. So your next reading thing through the Billy Jones story. So that's your Judge Dredd case files for this week. Now, we're going to finish up tonight's show with a creator spotlight. I mentioned earlier that I had spoken to Chris Fizikas, who is the creator and writer of The Last, when we were at Connecticut Gamer Con a few months ago. And now you were going to hear that interview. So you'll hear us talk about the fact that we're both big gamers, the fact that we both love world building. And you'll sort of hear some of the inspiration that Chris had for this series and what he wants to try and accomplish with it. So our thanks to him for being our guest on the show tonight. That is going to wrap up this particular episode of the Secret Identity Podcast. So for Mr. Matthew Herring, this is Brian Letendry signing off. Have a great rest of your week, and we will talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
Alrighty, and this is Brian here on the very first day of the very first Connecticut GamerCon, and I am sitting here with writer Chris Fizikas. How are you today, sir?
Not too bad. And yourself?
Thanks for having me, by the way. Hey, thanks for coming on. We were doing the rounds in the vendor room, and I saw our good buddy Matt Ryan of Free Lunch Comics was there, and you were there with him because your book, which is put out through Simple Comics called The Last, is here today as well. So can you tell us a little bit about The Last and sort of what brings you to this con today?
So first thing about The Last is it's a sci-fi fantasy. Biggest thing, without giving too many details away, is that it's actually about a alien boy who is thrown into a world that his parents tried to hide him from. And you are along for the ride on it. Reason I'm here at the con is actually Matt did get a table here, booth. I personally love video games, so I was going to come regardless. And now it's time to spread the word of The Last.
And you just mentioned that The Last is obviously a sci-fi story, and people wouldn't know this, but before we started recording today, you and I immediately bonded over the fact that we are both playing Mass Effect Andromeda right now. So clearly, you are a huge sci-fi fan. What as a fan growing up and loving sci-fi, did you want to take from the things that you sort of loved and bring into a story like The Last?
World building. I mean, The Last is a whole new universe. It's similar to Andromeda. You're in a whole new universe, different from Mass Effect 1, 2, and 3, but world building. I mean, you have galaxies, you have planets, you have different races all working together, and I really wanted to reflect that.
So being a D&D nerd, when you say world building, that really hits home for me, and I absolutely love that. That is one of the reasons that I got into writing as well, is for the world building of it. And I don't know about you, but like, do you have folders and folders full of the characters and the worlds and the planets and all the, and the lore and all that kind of stuff? Do you have your own personal codex for the world of The Last?
I actually do, and it gets bigger and bigger every day because people that read The Last always ask, hey, does this person have a backstory? Does this... The mom. Main character's mom has been a huge hit, and because of that, I now have had to create pages of lore for her. Yeah. So...
Have you been surprised, speaking of, you know, people, you know, kind of have, the mom has resonated with them, has it been surprising to you which characters sort of popped out of the book for people and what feedback you're getting regards to, as opposed to what you thought it might be?
Yes, definitely. I mean, the way I wrote the book was the son, the main character, is the focal point, but so many people have picked up off the auxiliary characters. I mean, there's a group of bounty hunters that I did not anticipate to really be a big deal, but I now find myself writing a quick one-shot with Cesar Feliciano.
Yep,
I don't know if you know him. Him and myself are going to be doing a one-shot just for these bounty hunters because so many people like him.
It's kind of awesome. You mentioned Cesar, and we've interviewed him on the show before. We know Cesar. It's kind of cool how all of us who are part of the same sort of convention scene in the New England area, these partnerships end up being forged. And one of the things that I always loved about Matt Ryan is that he is a... He's a bridger. Mm-hmm. You know, he brings people together. He helps people form partnerships. So what sort of led you to reach out to some of the creators that you were meeting at shows and want to involve them in these projects?
So it all started with Matt Ryan. I mean, he took me. I met him. I needed an artist for a book. I had this script that I wrote. And I was like, hey, what can I do with this? And he really took me and showed me the ins and outs of industry. He showed me who to speak to, who will help get this, who will help get that. And Cesar actually kind of fell into my lap. We both shop at the same comic shop. Uh-huh. And we met, loved his art, did a couple commissions for me. And I said, hey, let's talk. Ended up finding out short story that he is prior Marine Corps. Uh-huh. I myself in, so we kind of bonded on that.
And how has that been working with him? Because obviously anytime, and you worked with Matt, I should say, on The Last, mm-hmm. comics, that's what's so unique about them. You know, when I'm writing my prose stuff, it's me. When my timelines are my timelines and I get stuff done on my deadlines and things like that, I'm bouncing ideas off of myself. When you're doing comics, you are working with a team of people. Mm-hmm. And as you being the one who's sort of driving the creative vision, how has that been? Has it been a learning experience?
It definitely has. I did not realize how much co-working there was to be done. I mean, I wrote the script, I kicked it over to them, and it was, I pretty much had to let it go because Matt would come back to me, hey, you wrote this script like this, this page looks like this, I think the format looks better like this. It did. Yep. So it's a lot of give and take, and once you find that happy medium, you come out with a great book.
And I'm glad that you said that because I have found that working in comics and doing stuff with a team of people makes you so much of a better collaborator in every project that you do moving forward. You know, I co-write a series now with a friend of mine, and having done comic stuff before, that completely primed me for that because it is this sort of process where even though it's your idea, when you open the door and you let other people in, you have to be willing to accept that feedback. And so clearly at the end of the day, it's a better project for it. And I just looked at the pencils that Matt did on The Last, and they're absolutely gorgeous. So clearly you guys have formed a wonderful partnership there. So the first issue is here. What are sort of the plans for the series moving forward?
So it is going to be a 6-issue story. We will be turning it into a trade, obviously, at the end of the 6. And that's going to follow the main character from beginning to end. There are going to be branch-offs, like I mentioned. We do have a one-shot with the bounty hunters that you will encounter. And there are going to be other branch-offs in this massive universe I'm creating. So it's not just the characters you're going to meet. I'm going to introduce a whole new galaxy.
And for people who aren't here today and can't pick up a copy of the booth, where can they go to get their hands on the series?
So you can find me on Facebook, Chris Fizikas. It's a picture of me with my Superman hat on. or you can even find our Facebook page, Simple Comics. shoot us a message, and I will gladly send you an issue.
Awesome. Well, we will put links to both of those places in the show notes, and we wish you a ton of success with this book, and I'm sure that we will see you around on the con circuit in the near future.
Of course, and thank you for this. I mean, it was great to bump into you guys, and I look forward to doing this again.
Yeah, and we can bond over Mass Effect off the air again as we get a little farther into the game, because we really just started it. But yeah, it's always great to meet a fellow gamer and sci-fi fan.
Yep.
The greatest superheroes come to the Mohegan Sun August 18th to the 20th. Terrificon, Connecticut's number one Comic-Con, returns. Meet actors from the Game of Thrones, Flash, Guardians of the Galaxy, Stranger Things, and a special tribute to TV's Batman, Adam West, on Saturday night. 300 exhibitors, including top artists from Marvel and DC. See the Batmobile, the Batboat, even the Batcopter. It's Terrificon, Connecticut's terrific Comic-Con, Mohegan Sun, August 18th to the 20th. Tickets at Mohegan. Mohegan Sun Box Office or Ticketmaster.com. See more at Terrificon.com.